Hello, Will.
Hi, Rohan.
How are you doing?
Not too bad. This is quite exciting.
It is very exciting. It's the first time we've done anything like this.
Yeah, we don't have a song yet to introduce us, but we will eventually.
We will eventually. If you're hearing this, you might already have listened to the song. We hope you enjoyed the song.
Yeah, I imagine you're also our millionth subscriber, so...
Yeah, look out for that Audible subscription. Voucher anytime soon. So, Will, just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Obviously, my name is Will. I studied psychology at university, studied at Oxford. Obviously, it's going to tie into what this is all about later. What else is there about me? I mean, I don't want to get... How personal are we going here?
Oh, to tell us one personal thing.
One personal thing. I was going to say where I lived, but I don't know if that's sensible. Yeah, why don't we say, studied psychology at Oxford, that's great. Grew up just outside of London from a very big
family. Why don't you tell us about your love of fruit and veg?
My love of fruit and veg is going to be a very short podcast. I've been told by friends and colleagues that my diet is not super healthy. We could do a podcast about healthy eating and you could give me loads of evidence why I should, and I will refute you.
For those of you at home, Will's very tactfully avoiding the fact that he's never eaten fruit in his entire life.
Not quite right, because I eat olives.
Oh, okay.
But people don't normally accept that as... it's not in the category of real fruit for a lot of people.
Yeah, I wonder why.
I don't know. I really don't know. But anyway, enough about me. Tell me about yourself, Rohan.
So, hello. My name is Rohan. So I studied medicine at Cambridge, and then went on to start a company called Unique Missions, which I still run. Essentially, we help students with their applications to competitive courses in university. So we're essentially a big, big prep school. An interesting fact about me. So I think it kind of ties into the Oxford and Cambridge thing, but I've actually run and managed the world's seventh best party in the world. Nice. So with a multi-million pound budget and a £100,000 firework budget.
Not bad.
So it was a good fun. It was a very busy night.
I see that. Well, because I went not this last year, of course, but the year before.
Yeah.
Which you must have been. Yeah, sort so of
I've
around
done,
there.
I think I've done it every year now, apart from 2018 when I couldn't make it because there was literally an earthquake in Japan and I got stranded with flights back home.
Okay.
So I typically say that it takes...
Your operational skills would have been very impressive if you'd been able to still do it.
It takes literally a national disaster to keep me away from these.
Okay.
So I really do enjoy them.
Okay. How come you don't manage Keys's ball?
The budget's too small.
Okay. Okay.
No, Keys only does it every other year, and unfortunately it coincides and conflicts with John's, who also do theirs on Tuesday.
Because when I went, basically my friendship group was split. Half were going to Keys and half were going to John's. It was very sad, because it was always nicer to just do it all together. But strange that I've always found it so weird that, and they do this in Oxford sometimes, when they have balls on the same night, there aren't like 52 balls happening. You could spread it out evenly through the year and everyone would be happy. They still manage to do it.
There's a risk that one student would actually go to all 50 balls there as well.
Is that a risk? Is that a problem, really?
Probably the university with chancellors and director of studies would probably agree that it was.
Maybe.
So anyway, I mean, we've alluded to this already, but in terms of our backgrounds, obviously Oxford and Cambridge have had a huge influence on them.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, you were there for a little longer than I was.
I was there for 6 years, so a little longer is an understatement.
Yeah, twice as long. You got twice as much Oxbridge for your application.
Twice as much longer came the bubble.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's obviously been and a bit more recent for me as well, so I guess more of a sort of recent effect on my life. But yeah, it means that hopefully we can talk with at least some authority about certain relevant topics, and obviously for new students which are thinking about going into something like that, if they want to. It's not always the right choice, but there's probably some things that we say which would be at least a little bit helpful for them and their process, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. And the whole point of this podcast is to kind of shed some light on issues that I'm sure thousands of students face every year, and perhaps there's a bit of a gap in terms of information on how to exactly tackle them. So we're going to be covering some things that perhaps it's hard to get unless you're on the inside, as it were.
Yeah, and I think it's very easy to... There's a lot of stuff which is said, and it's very easy to take that, you know, and just think that that's true. You know, the amount of people that I speak to and they tell me something, and I'll just say, I've never heard that before. Where has that come from? So actually, you know, having a reliable source is really important for where you're getting your information from.
Yeah, absolutely. There was, so when I used to do punting at Cambridge, essentially you get into a wooden barge, and then you literally have a big pole that you kind of use to move yourself along. That there used to be these punt guides who used to do these tours for foreigners and tourists from all over the world, and some of the stuff they used to say was just unbelievable.
Oh, interesting.
So I used to hear things like Henry VIII sat on this throne, this chair here.
Okay.
And that King's College was like a massive chapel.
Okay.
It was built with one stone. People used to really lap it up, and I was like, but there's just absolutely no sense checking these things.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah, I knew someone who did the tours, and different tours will do it differently, I'm sure. I like to think they were saying the right stuff, but...
They do have scripts on it, because I remember one of them being taught by a senior puntitute.
So I think it's actually... One thing that I would have done when I was out at Oxford is actually volunteer, because my friend was studied psychology as well, and he did it over a summer. And provided you're not doing it with people that make stuff up, it's actually a really good way to learn more stuff about the city. Because it's very easy, you know, obviously I know a lot about my own college and, you know, different facts and tidbits, but probably don't know that much about Anne's or Queen's, whereas actually, you know, teaching is the best way of learning. So if you're forced to teach facts about Oxbridge, like unhelpful facts but interesting facts, then you probably get pretty good at it.
Yeah, absolutely. So Will, the kind of thing I wanted to start off by talking about, I thought it'd be quite good the first episode, was we obviously talk a lot about Oxford and Cambridge at work. But someone could rightly say, why is such a big why is such a big deal? Like, what's all the hype about?
Why bother?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's so much work to get there, and then you work even harder when you get in, and then often you go to jobs where you work even more.
Yeah.
So why kind of put all that energy and time, and why not?
So it's a good...
somewhere else.
It's a good question. Obviously, it's something that lots of students prepare for as part of their interviews, because they're anticipating something like that, but often they don't really get that anyway if they're sort of STEM-y. But it's obviously going to be different for each person. And, you know, obviously there's lots of, like, financial reasons, and I'm sure we'll get into that, and sort of career reasons. But, you know, when I was applying, I just thought it would be cool. And obviously I didn't say that at interview, you know, but I just sort of enjoy the idea of doing it. And for a lot of people, it's the challenge, right? I'm good at what I do, so I want to do it at the best place possible with the best people.
So it's like the Everest for the academics.
Yeah, you know, if you were a sports person, which I obviously I'm not hugely, but if you were a sports person, then you know, you'd want to go to the Olympics, because that's where all the that's how you know you've finessed your craft. Yeah, exactly. And I think it's the same thing, just a different modality. You know, it's a different disciplines that you're doing it in. So certainly for me, at least, that was what drove me. I wasn't overly thinking, well, I'll come out of this with a sparkly career. For a lot of people, that is the case. And, you know, there's lots of things to talk about that. But for me, that wasn't the case. I mean, and I get this a lot with people that I speak to about being a doctor. You know, why go to Cambridge to be a doctor if you become a doctor if you go anywhere else? Is that not something that you thought?
Yeah, it's a good point. I think when I was applying, I was kind of psychologically comfortable with the idea of not getting in, because obviously these are very competitive admissions processes. And what I did want to do was to get my hopes up too much, but I was a bit of a nerd and did probably over prepare for these, but it worked out. But I think, you know, that's quite an important thing. So sometimes when students don't get into Oxford and Cambridge for medicine, but they do have other offers, we normally say, look, just go to another medical school and you'll still end up as a doctor. I think for me, I was really, really into my science, and again, it was a little bit of what you were describing. There was this desire to kind of prove myself by being amongst the best, and then hopefully succeeding there. Obviously, I didn't know that age how much harder that would be.
Yeah.
You know, I think unless you've grown up with very like-minded, very intelligent people in a very academic setting, Oxford and Cambridge, you don't really know what they'll be like until you end up there. So, I mean, I don't know if this was the case for you, but when I was at school, I was pretty much the best in physics, maths, chemistry, biology. Sometimes there were people who kind of were, you know, on par with me. And I don't mean that in a big-headed way. Just,
yeah, very impressive.
But it was a small school, and you know, I was quite keen and interested in sciences. That certainly helped. But certainly when I got to Cambridge, I just felt very, very ordinary slash in the kind of bottom quartile. And that was really hard for me. Did you have anything like that?
So I think when I was at school, I think I sort of kept... I would surprise people that I'd do well. So I think, you know, when it was the... You'd have like a selection of people who all got just all A stars at GCSE. And they'd be like, oh yeah, him, of course. He got it, him as well. Why is Will standing over there? And I remember one of my teachers laughed at me. Well, you know, didn't laugh at me, but sort of... It was such a surprise that it sort of... She gave a little ha when I said that I was going to apply to Oxford. Because I don't think I exuded like academia... So I think that's, you know, it was, I wasn't sort of seeing myself as the smartest person at school. And so it wasn't, as, I suppose, as much of a culture shock when I got to Oxford. And maybe that's helpful. You know, lots of people do go there and they struggle with the fact that they're working very, very hard just to break even. But ultimately, you know, what I sort of think, or what I like to think, is that when you're there and thinking, gosh, he's clever or she's smart, hopefully they're thinking the same thing about you. But and you can kind of assume that, but you never know.
Yeah, and I think you're probably familiar with the concept of kind of imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
I was certainly kind of, you know, I think I felt, once I got in, I felt I had to really prove myself to kind of show that I deserved this place, because I felt I was surrounded by... people who are infinitely more intelligent than I was, which is a real shock when I've not really experienced it before.
Yeah, no, it's such a different... It's sort of the small fish... Big fish, small pond. Into big pond, small fish. And actually, you know, some people prefer being in the environment where they're on top and they're not really challenged that much. But as someone who's interested in learning and improving... You've got to put yourself into an environment where you're not the cleverest, you're not the best. I remember sort of there was some guy was teaching me chess when I was younger. He was a guy I met on a cruise. But anyway, he was teaching me chess when I was younger. And he was basically saying, because I'd always play with my younger brother. And he was saying, look, every time you play with your younger brother, you stay the same and he gets better. And so if you keep yourself in that environment where you're the better player or the smarter person, you're just going to stagnate. And, you know, the people that are learning with you, working with you, are going to learn more and more. And they'll eventually overtake you. So you always want to make sure that you're not the best player or the smartest person. Because otherwise, I mean, if you are the smartest person in the whole world, then that's great. But you're eventually going to not be the smartest person. Because someone else will overtake you.
I mean, on that note, do you think there is such a thing as the smartest person?
There's no genuine quantitative measure of smartness. I guess obviously they have IQ tests and that's fine, but not perfect. So obviously it's a reduction of you know the actual what's going on. But if you're let's say if you're trying to be the best at A level maths. And you're in a room full of people who are much worse than you at A-level maths, you're not going to get better at A-level maths, really. Or not, no, I think not at the rate that they will.
Unless you're a specific type of person, unless you're showing what's possible, you'll naturally gravitate towards perhaps just whatever you're at, plus 10, 20%. It's just hard to kind of make orders of magnitude of progress.
So
if you're getting 80% in your maths test, and you just accept that as good. Then that's okay. So I remember this is actually back all the way. It's bringing up painful memories now. But when I was in GCSE maths, I used to do really well consistently at 80-90% in my tests. I was pretty happy with that. And then we had an intake of new foreign students, and Okay. Some from India and China arrived, and they were just so much better at maths than I was. But actually, you know, they were getting 95, 99, sometimes 100%.
Not bad.
But actually, that motivated me to work even harder.
Yeah.
Because before I was kind of really coasting.
Mm.
And then by the end of that year, I was beating them consistently.
Nice.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you. I'm proud of my 16-year-old self.
Yeah,
but, the cool thing is, I think that other people can stretch you and inspire you, and we often hear about these with sports as well, is that you know, Federer and Djokovic always say that they rose to greater heights because their opponent
it's the rivalry which makes
it's
interesting. Speaking of maths, I was asked to drop further maths when I was in school because I was failing normal maths so bad. I struggled to learn C3 and C4 from my teacher, and I was doing terribly in tests, and I was taken aside by the head of maths, and he said, come on, let's just, you know, give yourself both years to do maths and do well in it, and let's leave further maths aside. And I said no, and sort of had to, I re-self-taught C3 and C4 and resat both of them. And so obviously the environment that you're in is very important, but also your own drive to succeed is going to be influential. Now, I wouldn't have done that if he hadn't taken me aside and said, look, you're at risk of losing further maths here. So I needed that external thing to kick me off. But actually, you know, I speak to lots of students who are like, well, I'm not quite the top of my class at the moment, but there's a lot that you can do to fix that yourself. And I basically just had to, instead of relying on my teacher to be able to tell me everything I needed to know, had to, you know, go through the textbooks and just do it myself. But yeah, it's well, environment / yourself, which is more important.
This is a huge component of it, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, thinking onto that, that when I was 10 or 11, my piano teacher just told my mother that he will never be a pianist because he's only learning one piece every 6 weeks or so.
Okay.
And I took that super personally, and in an effort to prove him wrong, I then learned one piece a week, and actually I did my grade 8 at the age of 16 or so.
Okay.
Which, you know, probably regressed quite significantly now. But the point was, him saying no to me was kind of the motivation I needed. And sometimes if you're applying to these kind of top tier universities, be prepared for that kind of shock initially.
Yeah.
But it can drive you to much greater heights in the long term.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's the people who sort of take things as given, who end up not sort of putting the effort in, then end up disappointed and surprised when things don't go their way. But actually, if you think about it, there are, you know, lots of other people there who are close to you, performing at the same level as you or higher, but they're not taking anything as given.
Yeah.
In terms of, you know, thinking, oh, I'll just swan through and get an offer.
Yeah.
You know, they're still making sure that they're doing everything they need to do. And in that environment, you can't, I don't want to say you can't relax because that seems really high pressure, but you can't just sort of rest on your laurels and think, well, you know, I've got a decent GCSE track record, that's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially not nowadays. It's just so competitive, and, you know, pretty much everyone that I'm speaking to is stellar grades. So what do you do then? If everyone's got stellar grades, I'm sure we'll talk about that another time.
Yeah.
We're setting up our schedule of podcasts pretty nicely.
Yes. Nice teasers along the way. So, I mean, when you applied to Oxford in your interview, I'm sure they asked you why Oxford. What were the kind of reasons that, I mean, the interview answer that you gave, if you remember?
I don't think they asked me why Oxford. We talked about why I wanted to do psychology. And I talked about, I and you'll notice this, but I take the psychology isn't a science insult quite personally, and I you know, obviously feel quite strongly like it's a really important field, with lots of very scientific stuff going on, some non-scientific stuff, fair enough, but I think there was, even in the psychology A level, one of your exams, you'd write an essay on whether psychology was a science, and I'd write it very fervently. And I basically said, well, look, it just seems to me to be the area with the quickest, there's the most to learn and the most to find out. Obviously, you know, other scientific fields, they've been around a lot longer and there's lots of new stuff happening, but they'll be relatively saturated in comparison to psychology, which, like, as a practice, you know, has been around for a while, but as a sort of scientific discipline, it's relatively new. And sort of, I talked about how that was appealing to me, and they were like, well, why is that appealing to you? And again, that's sort of the nature of their questioning. But it just meant that I suppose I could, there was a higher chance of, from a skeptic's point of view, I was sort of saying, well, there's a higher chance of me finding something interesting or like discovering something. Whereas if everything's been discovered and we've only got a small slither left undiscovered, obviously that's not the case, but that's how I felt at the time.
I kind of understand where you're coming from. I mean, there's a reason, for example, there's very few courses to study anatomy now. It's just because anatomy's been, you know, we've done it, we've completed it, as it were, as the science. It's really not that much left, at least on a microscopic level. But things like chemistry or physics, is just so much more that can be revealed. So I completely understand. So, I mean, looking back on it now, would you apply it again?
I really enjoyed Oxford and really enjoyed the course. And we were talking the other day about sort of people enjoying wherever they go. And you know, firmly believe that as humans, you convince yourself that your decisions are the right ones. You know, if you, let's say you applied to Keys, but you got pulled somewhere else, within the first year, you'd probably be saying, oh gosh, I'm so glad I got pulled because those Keys people, they're trash. Whereas the other way around, if you got into Keys and you weren't pulled, you think, oh, thank goodness I made it to Keys and wasn't pulled because I really like it here. Obviously, provided the experience isn't drastically horrific, you will convince yourself that you made the right decision. I probably would have been more than happy studying at UCL or wherever, but actually, I don't feel that way. I feel like actually the only place that really worked was there and then.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm sure there's a psychological phenomenon.
I imagine so. If there is, I should probably know it. But
yeah, I think, you know, it's the same as we were talking about. Is if you were called Mark or your name was suddenly changed to Mark, you'd probably think I'm not quite a Mark on the will.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's a very good analogy in that respect. As you grow into your name and you grow into your college and university as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, obviously when you go to uni or college, you find a group of friends that you like, but they could have been anyone. You could have ended up somewhere else and found a completely different group of friends and been just as friendly with them. So actually friendship is like, you know, strange and not, it's sort of made up, but actually that's a bit too, we could spend another session on that maybe, whether or not friendship is real, but like you will be happy, generally speaking, wherever you go, and you will convince yourself that you are, and you will find friends. And lots of people are very nervous about going to university, like, what if it's not right? But more often than not, it will be.
I think you find commonalities. I mean, I remember when on my first few weeks, people were like, wow, you like food too, I like food too. You need oxygen as well.
It's, yeah.
You know, obviously, but not as extreme as that.
Yeah, yeah.
People are quite keen and eager to kind of get together.
Yeah, I think I remember, you know, early on people were like, so what A-levels did you do? Maths? And it's, you know, but everyone is trying their best to be friendly and make friends. Like when you get there, you don't get there and you're the only one there who doesn't know anyone and everyone's already established their groups. You're all there, you're all feeling a bit nervous, you're all in a new environment. So actually, so long as you put in a bit of effort, everyone else is going to put in a bit of effort as well. A lot of people that I speak to are nervous about going to Oxford or Cambridge. And obviously it's easy for me to say, well, you really don't have to be. It's harder for them to believe that. But until you do it and you see, well, actually that wasn't so bad.
Yeah, it's a rite of passage, isn't it? Yeah. To
a certain
extent. And we've talked a lot about kind of the correct reasons to apply this kind of desire to climb the intellectual Everest.
Yeah.
What are some of the wrong reasons to apply or consider an Oxford education?
Some of the wrong reasons. So I personally think pursuing a career is not the reason to do it. It does, you know, it looks as if, you know, if you study at Oxford or Cambridge, that does set you up very nicely for a set of careers and, you know, your earning potential does seem to be higher than a lot of other universities. But I personally don't see that as a very strong reason to do it. I think you should do it because you really want to do your subject at that level. But naturally I would, because that's why I wanted to do it. Whereas for someone else who's a bit more career oriented, they might be like, well, why are you wasting your time doing your subject when you could be, you know, setting yourself up for a future? But that's just my personal take on it. A lot of people do it because other people want them to do it.
Mm. My granddad went here, so I'll go to this college.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And, you know, I've spoken with enough parents and then spoken with their son or daughter, and son or daughter is not bothered at all. You know, they couldn't care less, but obviously mum and dad are very keen on Oxbridge because they know that it's good for careers and things like that. So I think ultimately you've got to do it because you want to do it. Whatever reason that is, I don't really mind, but you've got to want to do it yourself.
And that's quite a difficult conversation sometimes, though, with the parents just kind of say, look, your child isn't really interested in this, it's not driven from you.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's a recipe for unhappiness, which is kind of why we don't advocate for it, I suppose.
Yeah, because ultimately, you know, we said already, it's a lot of hard work. And if you force your son or daughter to do a lot of hard work that they don't want to do, they're not going to thank you for it.
No.
I mean, you could say, well, actually, there are some things which my parents got me to do when I was younger, which actually I'm quite glad they did now, maybe didn't enjoy at the time. But I think by the time you're 16, 17, if you still don't really want to go to Oxford or Cambridge, nothing's going to change in that, you know, 6 month period or whatever it is that you start working on it. Mm. So, yeah,
I think you're right. For me, Cambridge was always just kind of this pinnacle, you know, academic Everest that we talked about. But also, I think this is really badly understood by lots of parents and even students, is the reason these universities do so well isn't because they have huge amounts of money, endowments and world-leading facilities. All of that's obviously great, but the kind of thing that really sets them apart is the supervision system, or the
tutorial system,
as you'd call it. Which is, for those of you at home, essentially it's every week you get anywhere between 1 to 4 small group teaching. When I say small group, it's normally it can be 1-to-1-on-1, which is pretty intense.
But. Yeah, sometimes you get you're meant to have a 2-on-1 tutorial, but your tutee, your partner is unwell. So you just sort of rock up there.
Conveniently unwell for them.
Yeah, you're sort of, you saw them last night and you knew they weren't going to show up. But you're sort of like, well, how am I going to make this last an hour? Because they're obviously going to want to discuss things and maybe you haven't prepared as well as you should. But
so I remember when I was at Keys, I remember one of our supervisors was the person who discovered the renin-angiotensin system, which is where half the blood pressure tablets target. So yeah, it was a bit like being starstruck because you read about these things in textbooks, but you see the person. And that's just someone who I was meeting on a weekly basis, kind of teaching me, and that was just phenomenal.
Mm.
And I still had a similar one for anatomy and then biochemistry. So they are really intense, but I think that's the real thing that kind of sets Oxford and Cambridge apart, is that individual teaching attention. As far as I know, no other university does that. I think Durham does a few kind of small group sessions, but other universities have a few seminars, but nothing of that.
I think you can very often you get in medical schools, I think sometimes you can get like groups of 9, but actually you're sort of teaching each other rather than with a tutor, which is obviously quite a different way of learning, but not quite what they do at
having an Oxbridge Don kind of challenge you on intellectual concepts and take you further. And you know, I didn't used to look forward to them, but actually they were really helpful in solidifying my understanding. I'm really glad it happened.
And it's interesting, actually, so the ones that you prepared for and you'd done the reading were so interesting and helpful and you learned so much. And the ones that you didn't, you know, maybe you sort of, it's a topic you're not so keen on, or you've been really busy doing other stuff and you haven't really spent much time on it, so you're kind of helping someone else in your group pick up the slack. Those ones just, you don't come out of it learning anything, and it just goes to show, you only get out what you put in. You're only going to make the most of this person here and their understanding and their intelligence if you sort of probe them. Mm-hmm. And if you've done the reading and you've got good questions.
Yeah.
And you know that there are some tutorials that I look back on and I think, actually, I wish I'd put in just a little bit more pre-reading for that one, because I could have got a lot more out of it. But I think it also varies depending on the tutor themselves. You know, some tutors, actually no, I think it depends on the topic. Some topics I enjoyed a lot more, sort of prepare for a lot more, and then got more out of the sessions, and then enjoyed it more. It's sort of a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah.
I like MAPE, which was memory, attention, information processing. Therefore, I work hard at MAPE. Therefore, I understand MAPE more. Therefore, I like MAPE.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's difficult to get yourself out of a rut like that. But the benefit is, if you don't like something, you can drop it. And then you sort of focus in on what you like until by third year, you're only doing modules that you really, really want to do. It's very different to school where, you know, you've got to do all things and you don't have any choice on that front. I think I also enjoyed that. That's one of the reasons why I chose Oxford, because I thought the course had loads of choice. I'd misunderstood the course. It had less choice than I thought.
I think, you know, what you're describing is effectively optionality.
Yeah.
Kind of a pretentious word for it, but essentially that's what it is the ability to make decisions that with time.
Exactly.
That kind of opens your kind of future up from that perspective.
Mm.
So I think we should probably start wrapping up, but from my perspective, I just want to say the key thing here is that students should really apply because of an intellectual desire to do well in a subject and also the ability to learn from world-leading experts rather than perhaps the pretty buildings and the kind of skyline. All of that is quite nice.
It is quite nice, but it's not enough to drive you to get there or while you're there. You know, some students sort of say, well, I'm struggling a lot with school at the moment, and I think, well, actually, no, it's not gonna get easier, particularly with the medics. You know, you're signing yourself up for 5-6 years of bloody hard work.
For now. More on that later.
More on that later, yeah. When's the big reveal? 20 episodes in. But yeah, so you've got to really want to do it.
So to wrap things up,
yeah.
Every week
we will do
a world's wisdom section. So what wisdom do you have to impart on us?
Yes, so this week I thought start things off, keep it Oxbridge related, and I'll endeavour to find a broad range of variety of things to learn through the coming weeks. A bit of history about my college. So obviously there's lots of different colleges and they all have lots of different interesting histories. But Christchurch, which is where I studied, was basically used as the royal headquarters during the Civil War. So when the king had to flee London, I can't remember which king, but one of the kings had to flee London, they moved to Oxford. The king lived in the deanery, which is where the dean lives in now. So if you're the dean of Christchurch, you live in technically a royal palace, which is anywhere where the royals have lived. And the hall where you have dinner or breakfast or lunch when you're at college was used as parliament during that period. I can't remember how long that period was for, but obviously they, you know, must have been quite different back at the time to sort of turf out all the religion students and put in the politicians instead.
Well, you say it's quite different. I think quite recently saw a painting of Oxford from the 1800s and then the exact same road currently, and really much of change. So
okay.
My old master at Keys, in our graduation speech, he used to say that one of his best jokes was how many Cambridge academics does it take to change a light bulb? And he said, change. So yeah, some of these things don't change. Well,
like
normally Will does these, but just to chime in with your one. Did you know, Will, that Cambridge has a lot more Nobel laureates in Oxford?
I didn't know that. Tell me more.
It's about 90 to 60. So given that in theory it's been around for a lot less proportionate, it's quite a big difference.
Is that so, Nobel laureates across like anything?
All the fields. Okay.
That's very interesting.
You've got some catching up to do.
Lots of catching up. Maybe. I think I could, you know, put together about 5 myself, but I don't think I can make 30.
Maybe for next week.
Yeah. Maybe. Guys, I've got a Nobel Prize now.
Yeah, well, you can tell us about this. Yeah, you can do a speech rehearsal.
Absolutely, absolutely. My acceptance speech.
Oh, awesome. Great. Thanks very much, Will.
No problem. Thanks for having me.